Hey everyone, my name is Juliana Peterson and I'm a third year medical student at the University of Arizona. I'm at Revive as a student ambassador and volunteer and I'm happy to be here.
And I'm so excited to be here at Revive. I'm looking forward to getting a little revived myself. Some awesome workshops, really cool people, and a little bit of sunshine.
Hey, this is Kat Ogle, and I am at the Revive Conference coming from Washington, D.C. at GW.
I'm Jennifer Whitfield-Bellows. I'm an EM doctor at Denver Health Hospital, and I'm here to reinvent my career on some level.
Currently, I am living in Kentucky. It's beautiful, but what's more beautiful is being at Revive. The reason I came to Revive is because I wanted to see my friends. These friends are extra special. These friends support, coach, encourage, and always have my best interest in mind.
Welcome to the Feminem Podcast, the official podcast of Feminem, discussing all things femme, a little bit of EM, and everything in between. I'm Risa E. Lewis, hosting the podcast live from Revive, a Feminem development retreat in Scottsdale, Arizona. It gives me extreme pleasure to introduce my guest today, Dr. Madel Briggs. Hi, Madel.
Hi, Risa. Thank you so much for having me here.
Audience, we're in for a real treat. I want to give a little bit of a heads up regarding this series, this podcast series of Revive. All proceeds from Revive will support the new Gender Equity in Medicine Research Foundation, which supports research to benefit feminems everywhere. I'm going to tel you a little bit about Madel. She's quite accomplished. Madel Briggs, MD, MPH, MSHS, is an assistant professor of emergency medicine at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA. She serves as the director of quality of emergency medicine for UCLA Health. In addition to her academic positions, Madel is the founder and CEO of Contour Health Solutions, a national advisory firm that provides clinical expertise to health technology companies and investors to create high-performance technology that improves the quality, safety, and efficiency of healthcare services. Wow, that is a lot. Don't worry, everybody. Madel will break it down for us. So Madel is here running a workshop at Revive, and I'm just going to fire some questions. Madel, first of all, what brings you to Revive? How did you get here? How did we have the honor of having you before us?
Oh, well, good question. Actually, we have a group in Los Angeles of all of the women in emergency medicine. And we were actually having our own sort of mini retreat at one of the faculty's houses. And I gave a quick presentation on negotiations, and Diane Birnbaumer was there. And she was like, you know, this may be something that we need to have at Revive. And so I had already looked at Revive anyway, and I was already planning on coming, but also being able to offer some negotiation strategies to all of my colleagues in emergency medicine, as well as talking about my journey in entrepreneurship, it was a perfect match.
Awesome. So Madel is going to be presenting a workshop, and actually has a few presentations, but what we're going to be focusing on today is her workshop entitled Entrepreneurship: How Following Your Passions and Purpose Can Lead to Greater Service, Impact, and Freedom. So why don't you, what do they say the term is these days? Why don't you unpack that title? Tell us about this workshop.
Yes. So first, I would probably say, let me just sort of go through my journey of entrepreneurship.
Please.
So I was one of those precocious young kids at the age of 5 who decided that I wanted to be a doctor. And the reason why I decided I wanted to be a doctor is because my aunt, who was actually a nurse practitioner, she saw me one day playing with her stethoscope. And my aunt came over to me. She said, oh, do you want to be a doctor? And I thought that was fascinating because she didn't say, do you want to be a nurse? She said, do you want to be a doctor? And from that moment on, I decided I was going to be a doctor. And so I continued a course through my education. And it really was when I went to undergrad and I was involved with a lot of the health organizations that the emergence of health inequalities really sort of hit me in the face. So especially in Los Angeles, in which we have so many different diverse communities, and especially diverse in terms of socioeconomic status, even at the young age of 18, 19, 20, I could not understand why there was not equal access to healthcare for everyone. And so I then went to Harvard Medical School for my training. And that's when a seed was planted, because it was there that I felt like they were saying over and over, like, it's your job to change the world. It's your job to make an impact on the world. And I said, okay, great, but how do I do it? And so I said, okay, well, maybe that's to go ahead and get my master's of public health. And it still wasn't enough. And then I then went on and came back to Los Angeles to Harbor UCLA to train. And I was able to see, of course, through our world as emergency physicians, really the social and the health ills that so many of our patients continue to suffer from. And that calling was still in me. I was like, what is my purpose? What am I supposed to be doing? How can I actually truly change the world? And so after fellowship, I did the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Clinical Scholars Program. And once again, it was just sort of beat into us of, it's your job to change the world. It's your job to make an impact. And I'm like, yes, but tell me how. Yeah. I don't know how.
Yeah.
But then something happened, and I looked around at all my colleagues during fellowship, and it's a multidisciplinary fellowship. So there were emergency physicians, internal medicine physicians, surgeons, obstetricians. Almost every single discipline was represented. So I remember still to this day, I told my cohort, I was like, hey, let's go have coffee. And so we all went down and we had coffee, and I said to them, why don't we start a consulting firm? And they're like, start a consulting firm? I was like, yes, look, we're all here. We're all here for the good of our communities and patients. We all have different specialties. Let's start a consulting firm. And half of them looked at me like I was crazy. And the other half were like, huh, well, why don't you go ahead and lead on that, Medill?
Let us know how it goes.
Right, let us know how that goes and then come back to us. I still went on, and I didn't start the consulting firm then, but I had the privilege of joining the faculty at UCLA as a health services researcher, and I really started to get more into quality. And around that time, it was decided that there was going to be a new hospital built in South Los Angeles, and that was the new Martin Luther King Jr. Community Hospital.
Is it related to when Drew closed or different?
It's related. Okay. So the old King Drew Hospital closed in approximately 2007. And so it was then decided that by the legislators and the community that, hey, we need to actually build a new hospital. And so through a public-private partnership between the Los Angeles County as well as UCLA, it was decided that a new not-for-profit private hospital would be established. So it was no longer going to be a county hospital. It was going to be a completely new private hospital. And so the UCLA CEO asked me, like, hey, Medill, this new endeavor is going on. And I also knew the new CEO of the hospital, and they said, hey, Medill, this is going on. And so I was asked to actually go to the MLK Community Hospital to serve as the first quality executive by both of the CEOs. And my job there was to literally help to build the quality infrastructure from scratch. I mean, there was no building, there were no staff, there was no workflows, nothing. It was completely a brand new hospital that we were building. And it was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity just to be able to create a hospital from the very beginning and putting in all the pieces that you would think that it would need. But it was definitely a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity because it was there for a community that needed it most, a community that's been plagued with social and medical inequities for decades. And it was the most amazing experience, and I continued to work hard. Not only was I over the quality infrastructure, but I was also the lead physician on all of the technology. So I helped to design and implement all the technology enterprise-wide. And so that's even more of where my love from technology came. But the hours were long. The hours were hard. It's hard enough building a startup organization. It's really hard to build a startup hospital. And that's where things started to change a bit. And the things that started to change were I was working so hard, I was neglecting my husband and my two children. I would leave early in the morning when my kids were asleep, and I would come home late at night when they were asleep. And it started putting a lot of stress on my marriage. And most importantly also, I just was no longer happy. The long hours, the hard work, although it was a privilege to do so, I realized that something needed to change. And so the real time that I realized that it needed to change was I was in the emergency department back at UCLA overnight, and it was around 12:30 in the morning, and I remember hearing critical pediatric trauma. And so we all know, like, when you hear that critical pediatric trauma, you're like, oh my goodness, like, what is coming in? And the ETA was 5 minutes. And so I got my team and all my residents and my nurses were already in the trauma bay. And immediately the paramedics walked in, and I could tell by the look on their face that this wasn't going to be a good situation. And I looked at the little boy, a little African-American boy around the age of 10. And his mother was there holding his hand as the paramedics were doing CPR on him. And she was completely covered in his blood and with tears streaming down her face. And I looked at the paramedics again, and they said to me, they kind of whispered, they're like, no signs of life. And so we brought him into the trauma bay. We put him on the gurney. And my chief resident looked at me like, are we going to do something? Because we all knew that he had been dead for a while. And I looked at my chief resident and the rest of my team. I said, start resuscitation. And the reason why I said that is because at that point, we all knew we couldn't do much to save the little boy. But now his mother was our patient. And as a mother, I also felt so much of her pain. And she needed to know that we were going to do whatever we could potentially do to save her son, and that she needed to see that process. And so as we continued, I took her to the side and I explained to her how her son's heart wasn't working, how he wasn't breathing, and that he had died. And the wail that she let out in the emergency department was the most piercing that I've ever felt, although I've been in this situation many times. But I think it was because at that moment, it really hit me because, one, that could have been my son. He looked like my son. And also, I knew that life could be gone in a split second, and I was not living my true life. Although I was doing so much good, that still wasn't my purpose. And that was the day that I said, okay, I'm done. And 6 weeks later, I actually resigned and I started my company.
Remarkable. And thank you for sharing that story. Many of us who practice emergency medicine or are in critical care situations can relate to those scenarios. And that's quite a dramatic one. We could even say traumatic. And I think to have that foresight of purpose of what you were doing and who is being resuscitated, and sort of, we see people at one moment in time, but we're very aware that people remember us forever. Okay, so take us to the next step. What was the next chapter?
So the next chapter was the beginning. So after I decided that I was going to make a change, not only for myself, but for my family, I started Contour Health Solutions. And so what Contour Health Solutions is, as you mentioned, it is a clinical advisory firm that actually partners directly with healthcare innovators as well as investors. And the way that this sort of came about is really because I've gotten to this point in my life in which I feel that, yes, we can do a lot of great work directly in the emergency department or directly in the hospital. But sometimes a lot of the great work that we need to do to actually change health and wellness is from the outside. And one of the things that is really one of my gifts is that I'm very strong and very knowledgeable of technology. I almost like to say I'm bilingual because I speak tech. And then, of course, I speak clinical care as well. And I realized that so much of what we were doing, there was really no communication between the technologists and then we as physicians or nurses or the rest of the clinicians in the hospital. And so I wanted to be able to still be in that environment where it's sort of a startup and there's innovation and we're doing something really good, not only for patients, but for communities. But of course, the reason why I started my company was that so I could also have more time and availability to be with my family. And so now my company has grown significantly over the past few months to a year. And I actually have clients throughout the country as well as some sites internationally. And what we really do is that we do clinical assessments. And so before an investor may go and actually invest their hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars into a health technology company, we're the team of clinicians that come in and say, hold on, wait, let's see what this is. Is it built correctly? Is it really addressing the needs of the patient? Is it really going to produce the outcomes that the entrepreneurs are saying that it's going to produce? And we sort of give that feedback back to the investors. On the flip side, directly with the entrepreneurs or with the health technology companies, we do the same thing. They come and they say, hey, I have this great new mobile app. And it's like, okay, but what is your application going to do? Have you thought about these clinical workflows? Which patients are you really trying to focus on? And so we help to provide that clinical expertise.
We know a lot of people, we all have friends who are physicians. They're like, I'm going to make an app. I'm going to patent this new technology. I have a quicker device to get this procedure done in the emergency department, as an example. How many people actually usually go through a company such as your own and get that consultation and advice, or how many people just try to go to production and push it through?
So the vast majority try to go directly to production because my company is actually one of the first of its kind. And so there are several other consulting companies that really focus on the technology or their business development, but there's not as many that actually focus specifically on the clinical design and what we really call the clinical due diligence. So investors, for instance, they do their financial due diligence, their business due diligence of a company, but oftentimes they do not have anybody with a true clinical background in order to evaluate these companies. So this is actually a novel idea, and it's a newer type of company. So, that's why I established it, because I saw the need.
Yeah. What's interesting, one of my friends who is not a physician works with a lot of physicians and has said, you know, the problem with physicians is they think they're the smartest people in the room. And they're often not the smartest, or at least there are people that are equally smart that just happen to not be physicians. So to that end, I think we would know why perhaps certain friends would go ahead and just push it through to production and not get the consultation and not get the input. I remember reading a Harvard Business Review article in early 2000s that talked about proven technology, tested and true technology. It can actually take 10 to 15 years to actually penetrate healthcare and medicine. You and I both know medicine actually has the ability to be quite conservative. We ourselves consider us open-minded, progressive, maybe even liberal. And, you know, we move faster than that. We're emergency medicine. But actually for technology that's proven and true and helpful for patient care, it takes a while to penetrate. What are your thoughts on that?
You know, it does, or at least it has historically. However, the new trends that we're actually monitoring in health technology and wellness technology is actually changing pretty quickly. So the average cycle now is about 5 to 8 years. Even if you think of things such as, oh gosh, like before, like with our smartphones, like there were no mobile apps that were monitoring our sleep patterns or actually making recommendations in terms of health education. And now those apps are everywhere. So what's going on is that technology is moving at such a fast pace. Although health technology is still a little bit behind some of the other industries like fintech or edtech, health technology is catching up. And we actually are in the era of health technology. And we're going to start seeing some really fascinating new emergence of technology that's not only going to help our patients, but it's actually going to help us significantly even in the emergency department or in the hospital.
So Madel, how many people do you know are in the space you're in? You have an MPH, you have an MSHS. Why not an MBA? Is an MBA necessary to be able to intersect these worlds of business, tech, medicine? One more question among them. You're supposed to only ask one question at a time. I'm asking you many questions. Do you know a lot of people that are doing what you're doing, intersecting many spaces?
So there are many people that are intersecting two or more spaces. Now, in this space where I am, where it is truly applying my clinical knowledge with technology, with also with business, there are not that many people in this space. And I think it's just because physicians and nurses in particular, we're just now really getting into technology and understanding its importance of how we can actually help to shape it in order to help our processes as well as patients. However, to your point about an MBA, that is a really good question, because I think a lot of our listeners and a lot of us are thinking, well, you know, I'd love to start a company, but do I have to go get an MBA? And how do I even figure out what type of company that I want to start? And the first thing I would say is no, you do not have to have an MBA. And a lot of the things that come into MBA, and I don't want to speak for having or what happens with MBA or not, since I don't have one, but a lot of it is more sort of the theory behind business. And really, in order to start a successful company, you really need to have the skill sets as well. I think an MBA will help you if you want to go that route, but you do not have to have an MBA in order to run a successful company. But it is something that you do have to actually learn a large amount of skill sets in order to understand the principles of establishing a business, of running a business, and of growing a business. And it's very different from medicine. It is completely different from medicine. But I think we as physicians, we make wonderful business people once we have those skills, because we're incredibly focused as physicians. We're incredibly dedicated and committed. And those are some of the key values that you need to have to open and run your own business as well.
Okay, so if I get this correctly, I don't need an MBA. Do I need to play golf? Listeners, Madel and I had actually a whole side conversation before the podcast about playing golf, and you may or may not be surprised by what she has to say. Do I need to, so Madel, do I need to play golf? Do I need to join and play golf?
So I will say that if you golf, you're going to close more deals. So I actually work in a new world which is dominated by men, not only men in the investment side, but also men on the entrepreneurial side. So literally 80% of all my clients are all men. And the reason why I play golf is because the deals take place on the greens. And so a lot of times men get together and they chit chat and they're golfing, and that's how they get to know each other. And literally deals are made and closed on the greens. So I make sure to know how to golf so I can sit there with the guys as well. And we can all just spend time with each other. And then we can actually get down to business and move forward from there. And the most important thing about golfing is that it's not about the sport itself. It is truly a network and a relationship building activity. And so sometimes some people like to do it on the golf course. Other times people like to do it in a bar. Other times people like to do it in other locations. But so I would say you don't have to golf.
But it'll certainly help.
Absolutely help, depending on who your clients are. And my clients love to golf.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Are there any other top, you know, if we were saying the top three, and after golf, what's next in terms of places to close deals or develop those relationships?
That's a good question. I really feel that it really comes down to what type of business you're in. So for instance, I have a circle of women who are in business around me, and we all range from having a coaching type of business to developing new products. And so different companies require different avenues in order to meet people and also to close deals. But one of the things that I like to say to people that are thinking about business are three main topics. Number one, when you're thinking about what you should establish as your company, be true to yourself. And the reason why I say be true to yourself is oftentimes I feel that we are walking in somebody else's footsteps, or we're walking in this perception of who we should be versus who we really are. And starting your own company and running your own company is not easy at all. Just like being a physician is not easy, but I can tell you, being a physician, it's a little bit more of a straight trajectory. You kind of like go from, you know, high school to college to med school to residency, and you kind of know where you're going. Business, there is no plan. There is no script. You just sort of have to go along with the journey. And so you have to make sure that you know who you are, or you're learning who you are, so you can actually start a company that is most meaningful and most successful for you. And then the second thing is, as I mentioned, it's a journey. And so my second piece of advice is you have to commit to the journey. Again, starting a company and running a company, it is not a straight path. There are highs, there are lows, there are, you know, you're turning in circles, you're standing still. In fact, one of my business coaches told me that starting your own company is like being a boat on the open ocean, meaning sometimes you may have a destination, you have a goal in mind, but the winds may blow you to the left, the currents may blow you to the right, you may go really fast forward, or you may stand still. And so all you can do is sort of stop, re-navigate, and then go to, again, directly towards your destination. And business is truly like that. It is unpredictable, but if you like that and if you're committed to your purpose and what your company is for, then you'll get there no matter what. And then the third thing that I always like to tell people is to really have a support network. And I feel like there's always two different types of support networks. I'm highly spiritual, and I've become even more spiritual since starting my company. And there is a reason why a lot of the most successful business people in the world actually start every single morning with meditation. I mean, Oprah Winfrey, Warren Buffett, Bill Gates. I mean, we can go through many, many people, and they will all tell you they start their days with early morning meditation. And the reason why is because, again, to have that clarity of mind, to have that focus, to have that purpose, the purpose actually has to come from something higher than you. And so whether you believe in God, you know, Jesus, Allah, whomever it may be, there just has to be something higher than you that you believe in, that you draw energy from, in order to make sure you understand your purpose and your intention. And then I also like to say, of course, your physical support structure. So the people that are in your corner supporting for the business. I can tell you that, you know, before my pre-company life, some of my work, my administrative work, really did put a test on my marriage. And now my husband's like my biggest cheerleader. And he's like, so what are we doing today? Like, what are you going to go? Which meetings are you going to have? And he's a big support for me, as well as many, as I mentioned, I have many other friends that are women that are in business and men that are in business. And then I also have coaches. And I say that a coach is very important. Again, we didn't become physicians by ourselves. We had attendings, and we had all of these people to teach us how to become a good doctor. Just like you don't become an Olympian without having a good coach either. You have to learn the skills. You have to learn the discipline. And so I felt having that support network of both friends as well as significant others and coaches, and of course, a higher calling and a higher being, is really, really important.
That's amazing. Madel Briggs, Dr. Madel Briggs, thank you so much for spending time with us. Audience, this is the Feminem Revive podcast series. Dr. Briggs is going to be giving us a workshop tomorrow. We've already gotten a sneak peek of some of the teaching points, some of the learning points that we'll hear. Look for more in the show notes on her company and on her workshop, Entrepreneurship, How Following Your Passions and Purpose Can Lead to Greater Service, Impact, and Freedom. Thank you. Thank you, Madel.
Thank you so much for having me here.